dear. Two things, if I may, she said, speaking very slowly and holding up two fingers. You understand?
Yes, what is it?
Is it true you speak only English?
To my shame, yes. Well, a smattering of Spanish, not enough to converse.
Do not feel bad, sir. I speak only Hebrew.
Well, your English is lovely too, young lady.
You do not understand.
I understand you perfectly. You speak English beautifully. She laughed.
You do not understand.
Abdullah leaned in, chuckling. And you are funny, young one. Speaking Arabic and yet talking about knowing only Hebrew. And Rayford, how is it you know Arabic?
The girl threw back her head and laughed. We all speak in our own languages and understand each other perfectly.
What? Rayford said. Wait!
Sir, I speak only Hebrew.
And Arabic, Abdullah corrected.
But no, I was forbidden to learn Arabic.
I need to lie down, Abdullah said.
You said there were two things, Rayford said. Yes, she said, holding up two fingers again. Two.
Rayford put a hand over her fingers. No need. I understand you. She laughed.
The second thing, and now she spoke more quickly, is that Doctors Rosenzweig and Ben-Judah request an audience with you.
With me? I should request an audience with them. I'm sure they are very busy.
They asked me to fetch you, sir.
Rayford followed her over piles of rock that had been blown to pieces by the bombs. Just inside a cave, by light from a torch lodged in the wall, Chaim and Zion sat with several older men. Zion introduced Rayford all around and said,
The one we have been telling you about.
The men nodded and smiled.
Praise the Lord, Rayford, Zion said.
Continually, Rayford said, but forgive me if I am preoccupied. Zion nodded again.
I, too, await word from our compatriots in Greece, and yet even now the Lord quiets me with his peace and confidence.
He may be trying to communicate the same to me, brother, Rayford said. But that one of them is my daughter may affect my faith. Zion nodded again and smiled.
Possible. But after what you survived here today, is it not fair to say that any breakdown in communication between you and the Lord has to be your fault?
Well, that goes without saying.
Oh, by the way, I am speaking Hebrew, and you are...
I know, brother, I have been all through that with the young lady. The others laughed, and one said,
My daughter!
Lovely.
Thank you.
Chaim and I have been talking with these brothers about plans, Zion said. We will be praying for the Tribulation Force members all over the world and are eager to see how God delivers them. But everyone needs accountability, and as Chaim and I are accountable to you, we...
Oh, Zion, no! Surely we're way past that.
You've been the spiritual leader for the Tribulation Force for some time and of the Worldwide Church of Christ for almost as long.
No, now, Rayford, hear me. Begging your pardon, sir, you always flattered me by deferring to me as the titular leader of the Trib Force, but please, these men, Rayford, are a good start for us here. They are the core of a group of elders I hope will eventually arise to help Chaim with the daily decisions, but they are, naturally, new to the faith.
As I am, Zion. Surely you're not suggesting. Excuse me, Rayford, but you forget. None of us is terribly mature in the faith. In years, anyway. I am not going to insult your intelligence by implying that I will seek your counsel on the scriptures, though I cannot deny I have learned from you. But God put you in a strategic place for me at a very dark time in my life. If you do not mind, I would like to run past you some thoughts regarding the immediate future and get your feedback.
If you insist, but at least concede that it was not I who stood in the midst of a million people and saw God miraculously spare them from the fires of hell.
Zion looked at him with a twinkle in his eye, then turned to the other men. They laughed uproariously.
Chaim pointed at Rayford and chortled. Was it not you? Then my eyes fail me. He turned to Ben-Judah. Zion, did I not see this very man standing in the midst of us, and could he have not seen what God did?
Well, okay, Rayford said, point taken, but I was not the reason the enemy attacked, Zion. You and Chaim were, and I was not preaching, not praying, not standing there full of faith when the bombs fell. Truth be told, my faith is stronger in the aftermath than it was in the fire.
Zion fell serious and ran a hand through his beard, studying Rayford. You would make a good Israeli, he said. Rayford shrugged. Zeke was going for the Egyptian look, but whatever.
No, I mean you argue like my countrymen. We could debate all night, and even when you are wrong, still you argue.
That brought more laughter from the others. All right, Zion. I don't know why you would want to hold yourself accountable to one you find it so easy to ridicule. All in good fun, my dear brother. You know that.
Of course.
But anyway, I'm listening.
Mac pulled his phone from his pocket and turned it on. What are they doing, Socrates? Your pals? Checking us out?
Socrates shrugged.
Come on, you won't hurt my feelings. They trying to make sure we're legit, that we're not going to jump them, embarrass them? What?
Mac punched in Chang's number.
There are no cells out here, sir, Socrates said. You won't get through to anyone.
Well, I wouldn't if I had bad technology, would I?
But what if I had a phone juiced by the sun and bounced by the satellites? Then I wouldn't care whether you've got cells in the woods here, would I?
But you won't be able to reach the commander unless...
This is Chang, Mac. You okay?
I'm fine, Supreme Commander, sir. Just checking in to see if my phone works all the way to New Babylon.
Loud and clear, Mac. Talk to me. What's going on? You in trouble? What can I do?
Fine, sir. How's the weather there?
Chang said. I've got my screen open to the GPS, and I'm tracking you and Jinnah and Irene right to where you ought to be.
Hang on, boss. Just a second.
Mac pretended to tuck the phone to his chest, but he held it lightly enough so Chang could hear.
What did you just say, Socrates? That I couldn't use my phone in the woods?
Yeah, well, obviously you can, with the satellite and all. But you couldn't talk to somebody unless they had the same thing, is all I was saying.
Who would I want to talk to here with my fancy phone who wouldn't have one?
Socrates paled.
Well, like, I don't have one.
Who else?
My partners don't either.
We have regular.
Thought I was going to call one of your partners, did you?
Well, no.
Of course not. Not unless their boss gave me their number, right?
Right.
But even then, I couldn't call them out here, could I?
No, that's all I was saying.
You were saying something else, weren't you, Socrates?
No, I was just talking.
You thought I was calling Commander Stefanich, didn't you?
No, I...
Didn't you?
Yes.
But you didn't think I could reach him.
Socrates nodded miserably.
But how would you know that?
I was guessing.
I can't get through to him in Ptolemais in the middle of all the cells?
You probably can.
But he's not there, is he?
How would I know?
Because he's here in the woods, isn't he?
Silence.
Isn't he, Socrates?
He shrugged.
So how did he let you and your team know I was coming? Couldn't call you, could he?
I am so stupid.
I'll grant you that, Socrates. Not living up to that name anyway, wouldn't you say?
Mac turned back to the phone.
Sorry to keep you, Chief.
I'm way ahead of you, Mac. I can beam a signal to that phone of Stefanich's that will make the bells and whistles blow, even if I can't talk to him on it. He'll get a readout that Deputy Commander Conrad, who reports directly to Security and Intelligence Director Akbar, wants to talk with him immediately.
Sounds good, Chief. I'll talk to you later. Things are going fine here.
When he calls, I will use the voice modulator that can make me sound like an old German, and I'll tell him that Akbar himself is holding him personally responsible for giving Howie Johnson access to Sebastian.
Perfect.
And if he doesn't call, I'll have that on his phone's readout in time to help you out.
Got you covered, Mac. Ain't that the truth, Commander? Max slapped the phone shut. Let me have that walkie-talkie, friend.
You're gonna get me killed.
Who, me?
Nah, you're a dead man anyway. Said so yourself.
Are you gonna kill me, or let her?
Max shook his head.
I'll leave that to your partners. Look on the bright side. If they're as effective as you are, you'll be eating breakfast in the morning as usual.
Socrates stared at him.
You eat breakfast, don't you, Socrates?
The man nodded.
Excuse me,
Max said, and pretended to mash the button on the walkie-talkie.
Now hear this, Plato, Aristotle, and Elena. I don't want to talk to any of you. I want Nelly Stefanich. Now, Nelly, I know you're close by, and I admire your creativity going by the book and all. I'm not even insulted that you're checking up on me. I'll make you a deal. When you get confirmation that me and mine are all we claim to be, I want you to personally bring Sebastian to me. You know where I am. And bring that team of philosophers out from under their rock so I can see them. If you can get that done, Nelly, I promise not to take your command. Oh, and Nelson? That's an order, and you've got 30 minutes.
Mac turned and gave Chloe and Hannah a look.
Now, Socrates, you're free to go.
What are you saying?
You heard me. Go on, get out of here.
Socrates struggled to his feet, then bent to pick up his weapon.
That stays, Mac said.
My radio, then?
He said, reaching.
Uh-uh. I'll keep that, too.
Where will I go?
Mac shrugged.
That's up to you.
Socrates sat on the edge of a flimsy table and rubbed his knee.
I am a man with nowhere to go. You want to be here when...
The man stood quickly, teetering.
No, no, but it is so far to town and with no protection or radio. I can't help you, friend. You're part of an operation that didn't follow orders. You're lucky to be cut loose considering the options. If you want to be here when the rest of your team...
Ah!
Socrates hobbled to the front door. Max signaled Chloe with a nod to watch him. He gingerly stepped through the wood chips and splinters and made his way out.
Follow him, Max said, till you're sure he's headed toward town. Hannah, check the perimeter. I'll clear this place, and we'll meet by the weapons out front.
Rayford felt a fool sitting in a cave, high on having personally lived through an Old Testament miracle, worrying about Chloe and entertaining even the possibility that Zion Ben-Judah himself should seek his opinion. He knew he would be reunited with his daughter regardless, but was it wrong to wish her spared from a painful, violent death?
You and Abdella need to decide what you will do, Rayford, Zion said. You are welcome to stay, of course, but I do not know how practical it is to expect you to oversee the Tribulation Force from here. Our computer people tell me that David Hasid and Chang Wang have somehow already put in place here the basis for a mighty technological center, and that the bombs had no effect on the hardware or the software.
Are you serious? Rayford said.
The electromagnetic pulse from the missile alone should have fried everything.
Everything is fine, praise the Lord. So you could conceivably keep track of everyone from here, but that is your call.
Oh, I will be leaving, Rayford said. I can't say when yet. I do worry about your returning to Chicago, Zion.
That is precisely what we have been discussing, Rayford. We do not know if it makes sense for any of us from there to attempt to return. Would not you and Abdullah be under as much scrutiny as I? Without another miracle, how could we return to the safe house without giving away its location?
The thought of finding a new safe house, of moving, wearied Rayford.
We'll worry about that, Zion. What are your plans? You could transmit your daily teachings from here.
Chaim interrupted.
That is my wish, and that of the elders here, and I dare say the rest of the people.
I do not know, Zion said. I will do as the Lord leads, but I believe Chaim is God's man here.
My work is done, Zion, Chaim said. God did it in spite of my feeble efforts, and here we are.
I shall hand off the baton to you, my former student.
I remain your student, Doctor, Zion said.
Gentlemen, Rayford said, the mutual admiration is inspiring, but it doesn't get us anywhere. This place needs leadership, organization, mediation. If you stay, Zion, you should be protected from responsibilities that interfere with your teaching. Here and to your internet audience around the world. The elders nodded.
Perhaps among us, Chaim said, we can ferret out young people with these gifts. I am willing to administer, coordinate a bit, but I am not a young man. This is a city, a country unto itself. We need a government. God provides food and water and clothes that will not wear out, but I believe he expects us to manage ourselves otherwise. We must organize and build, admittedly only for the short term, but still.
Maybe, Rayford said, that very work is God's way of occupying your time here. Living together, getting along, functioning in harmony will be a full-time job. Imagine the boredom of a million people just sitting around waiting for the glorious appearing. Zion warmed to this. Oh, that is why I believe we need to motivate people to help the rest of the world from here. We are not blind to the prophecies, to the machinations of the evil one. Trying to blow us up is only the beginning. He will think he can starve us out by cutting off our supply lines. He will not know or will not believe that God feeds us. But we know we are safe. What we must guard against are his schemes to lure the undecided away from this place, out to where they are vulnerable, not only emotionally and psychologically, but also physically. I am jealous to keep them here and to persuade them.
I don't understand, Rayford said, how anyone could remain undecided after today.
It is beyond human comprehension, Zion said, but God foretold it. Now my dream for the faithful here is that they be useful in the cause of aiding our brothers and sisters around the world. Peter warns us to be sober and vigilant, because our adversary walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. The evil one will grow angrier, more determined, more vicious, and many will die at his hand. What better, nobler task could the million strong here undertake than to aid your daughter's commodity co-op and equip the saints to thwart Antichrist? I envision thousands of technological experts creating a network of resources for believers, informing them of safe havens, putting them in touch with each other. We know we will lose many brothers and sisters, and yet we should offer what we can to keep the gospel going forth, even now. Rayford sat back. Can't argue with that. And it's not a bad idea, Zion, this becoming your new base of operation. We will miss you, of course, but it makes no sense to risk losing you to the cause when all you need is right here.
I have been thinking, Chaim said, and Rayford, feel free to correct me, as I am out of my element on this topic, but I wonder if the day of a safe house for the Tribulation Force is past. We know New Babylon is sniffing around and that it is only a matter of time before Chicago is exposed. Yes, perhaps we need a central location for the coordinating of the co-op, but if I were you, I would worry for my little one being moved hither and yon. I leave the details to you and your compatriots, but I ask you, is it not true that anyone who is asked to remain at the safe house quickly gets the cottage fever? The young man there, Zeke, who so masterfully equips us to venture out, might find moving around a nuisance, and the matter of record-keeping and computers is difficult. But perhaps the safe house of the future will be in 1,000 places, not just one.
Perhaps the time has come to make your home in the hiding places of the believers around the world.
Rayford feared Chaim was right, and it must have shown.
I am not saying it will be easy, Chaim said. But I urge you to take the initiative. Make the hard decision. Disband the safe house and disperse your people before they are found out, for then you could lose everyone at once. Surely you all know you have stayed in one place long past a reasonable hour.
Oh, I know that, Chaim, Rayford said. In reality, we haven't been at the Strong Building very long. Too long, no doubt, but not even as long as we were at our previous location. Zion stood and stretched.
We need to leave this with you. God will lead you. I intended to seek your counsel, and now we have tried to counsel you.
I appreciate it.
But please, Rayford, counsel me. Let me tell you what I believe God is impressing upon me, and see if it makes any sense to you. I know it will jar the sensibilities of many hearers, and yet I dare not casually disregard it. You see, because of what has happened since the rapture of the church, I believe there is ample evidence of one part of God's nature and character. Clearly, this is a time of judgment, even of wrath. We are in the middle of the last 7 of the 21 judgments of God, and we even endured one he himself refers to in the scriptures as the wrath of the Lamb. It would be easy for a preacher to illumine and drive home the truth of God's impatience, his judgment poured out on his enemies, his demand for justice for the blood of the prophets. But I have come to the conclusion that all this goes without saying. Yes, this is the last chance. Yes, everything has been telescoped into 7 last years, and we are already well into the second half of that. God will do what God will do, but I am jealous to protect his reputation. Oh, I know he does not need me, does not require my assistance. I am humbled to the depths of my soul that he has seen fit to allow me any role in ministering to the nations. But a profound and seemingly contradictory message presses on my heart. I believe it is of God, but it is such a paradox, such a dichotomy, that I dare not run ahead of him without the counsel of and wisdom of my spiritual family. Zion massaged his temples and began to pace. Gentlemen, he said, walk with me.
The crowds will press if you leave here, someone said.
They will see we are engaged, I am sure, Zion said. Let us not make a spectacle. Surround me, and let us move away from the masses.
The people still frolicked around the spring, while others filled containers and gathered manna. Rayford joined the elders and Chaim, and casually moved into a ravine and down a rocky slope. When they were clear of others, Zion talked as he walked.
I am not unaware that I have been bestowed a great privilege. I have a congregation here alone of 1 million souls. I have opportunity to teach the babies in the faith, offering them the milk of the word. I also enjoy breaking the bread and carving the meat of the deeper things to the more mature. And I am blessed to preach the gospel, evangelizing, for even here there are the undecided. We will not win all of them, a truth that astounds me, especially in the glow of an event such as we experienced just hours ago. But the point is, God daily refreshes me and allows me, expects me, to exercise all the gifts he has bestowed on a pastor-teacher.
When Zion stopped, the rest stopped. He sat on a rock and they gathered around him.
It may sound strange to you all, because I have said many, many times that this is the worst 7-year period in the history of mankind, but in many ways I count it an almost limitless benefit to be alive right now.
Technology has allowed me a congregation, if the figures can be believed, of more than 1 billion via the Internet. Someday in heaven I will ask God to let me get my finite brain around that figure. For now it is too much to take in. I cannot picture it, cannot tell you how many 100,000-seat stadiums it would take to house them all. Well, of course I know that 10,000 such stadiums would equal 1 billion people, but does that help you picture it in your mind? Me either. Now let me tell you what weighs on me when I think of the responsibilities I have to such a congregation. I believe the time has come to stop talking about the judgment of God. There is no denying it. There is no pretending that His wrath is not being poured out. But I have come to the conclusion that the whole message of God throughout the ages is an anthem to His mercy. Most of you know that this comes from a man who saw his beloved wife and children murdered. Am I saying that the holiness of God is less important than the love of God? How could I, when the scriptures say that He is love, but that He is holy, holy, holy? I am merely saying that I will let God's justice and judgment and wrath speak for themselves, and I will spend the rest of my time here championing His mercy. It seemed to Rayford that Zion took the time to look into the eyes of everyone who had heard him. He could have gone on, defended himself and his novel opinion, but he simply finished by saying, "You have until noon tomorrow to correct me if you believe I am a wayward brother. Otherwise, my teaching begins, and you know my theme." Buck was sympathetic to Albie. The diminutive Middle Easterner was wound tight, unable to sit still. "I can't live like this, Cameron," he said. "I am going to spend this evening with Zeke and look through his files. Have you seen his inventory?" "Of course. There has to be an identity in there for me. The GC thing probably won't work for me again, but I'll do anything, anything but sit around here. You think he could make me tall and blonde?" Buck had to smile. One of two wasn't bad. "I might join you," he said. "Zeke's a master, and this sitting around is going to kill me." "But you're right. You get to download all that stuff from Chang and get it out on the net. I love your son, Cameron, but trading off babysitting, reading, looking out the window, and waiting for everybody to check in is going to drive me crazy." "I know." "Have you spent much time with Mac?" Albie said. "Sure. Great man. Good mind. But we don't think the same. I can imagine all kinds of things he's doing in Greece right now that could get... Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting Chloe is right there with him." "What? You think Mac won't look out for Chloe? She's probably looking out for him." "I ought to be there, is what I'm saying." "Deputy Commander Conrad?" "That is correct," Chang said, his voice electronically modulated. "And this had better be Nelson Stefanich." "It is, sir, and Commander. I want to know what in the world is going on over there." "Yes, sir, I sent my senior commander all the way from New Babylon to talk directly with your prisoner." "And that will happen, sir. I don't appreciate him getting jerked around when you had fair warning and plenty of time to make arrangements." "I know, I'll expect a full report transmitted to my office by noon tomorrow." "I'll definitely do that, sir, because it is explainable. Is Johnson meeting with Sebastian now?" "Not quite yet." "Even as we speak? Because if not, I want to know why not." "There was some mix-up with our local team, sir. They thought they heard..." "I'll look for those details tomorrow, Commander. But meanwhile, I'm going to assume you're affecting this meeting." "Yes, sir." "And not making Johnson come to you?" "Sir?" "He's gone as far as I expect him to have to go. Anywhere he is a secure environment.
so you have your people get the prisoner to him.
Yes, sir. Deputy Commander, could I inform you of some good news?
There is no good news until I know Johnson has access to Sebastian.
I just wanted you to know that we have located the central underground headquarters in Ptolemais and plan to raid it at midnight.
Chapter 7. Chloe found it no chore to keep up with the lame Socrates. She watched him from inside the shack until he disappeared, limping down toward the road. Then she tiptoed out, went 90 degrees into the trees, hurried past the 50 and the DW, which her quarry had passed some 40 feet to his left. Chloe held tight to the grip on the Uzi, pulling the strap taut to keep it away from her body and from clacking into the Luger. She turned sideways and mint-stepped the decline, carefully crossing the gravel road. Stopping on the other side, she heard movement in the underbrush, someone heading left, east, hurrying and not worrying about snapping twigs and thrashing through the thick stuff. Chloe squatted and regulated her breathing, gauging direction and distance to keep from following too close and giving herself away. There was no need for her to step into the overgrowth. She could easily keep pace, staying at the side of the road in the soft, silent dirt. The only danger was overtaking her prey and being seen. It had to be Socrates. When he came even with the shack again, though he was below the line of sight from the front door, he stopped, apparently to listen. Hearing nothing must have encouraged him, because now out he came, maybe 50 feet ahead of Chloe, and also choosing to stay on the quieter surface next to the road. Chloe stood stock still in case he decided to turn around. She couldn't imagine being seen in the darkness, but who knew what kind of vision the limping, unarmed man might have. Some people could see or sense shapes in the darkness. Mac had proved that. And maybe this character knew the area, would notice a silhouette between trees that should have provided a clear shot to the stars. Chloe waited until he went around a bend, then hurried to where she could again hear the labored footsteps. She peeled her eyes and saw, or at least imagined, that he was testing the knee, trying to walk more upright, more normal, and not succeeding. Occasionally she heard a grunt or a moan. He was in pain, and he certainly was taking the long way to town. No, Socrates was going to lead her to George Sebastian. Chloe just knew it. Should she attempt a quiet transmission? Let Mac know Hopalong was headed the wrong way? How much of a lead could he get if that took 30 seconds? Mac and Hannah could catch up with her quickly, and they could overtake him in no time. But Mac was double-checking the shack, and Hannah was outside alone, making sure no ambush was afoot. Chloe would never forgive herself if a needless transmission gave someone an audible target. If Socrates led her right to this lean-to, or whatever it was, unless she was seen, she couldn't be in any danger. If the other three were there, even if Stefanich was there, she'd still have plenty of time to call for the others. Mac knelt in the cool dampness of the cramped cellar. The single bare bulb hanging from the ceiling revealed irregular shapes on the earthen floor. With his flashlight, he tried to determine whether George had been mistreated. It was impossible to tell if those were flecks of blood among the footprints and indecipherable shapes. "It's where I would terrorize a hostage," Mac decided. He shined his light in every corner, flipped off the cellar switch, and was headed upstairs when his phone chirped. Eager to get outside to the rendezvous, but hesitant to be on the phone in the open air, he paused on the stairs and flipped it open. Was it his imagination, or had he heard a voice from out back? He assumed Hannah would have done her perimeter scan and would be waiting with Chloe by the tree in front. Mac didn't dare say anything, so he just listened to the phone. Mac? It was Chang, but Mac didn't want to acknowledge. He pressed a button on the keypad. Mac, that you? He pressed the button longer. Okay, you can't talk, but neither can I until I can confirm it's you. One beep if the following is true.
two if it's false. After the first book in the New Testament, the next four have exactly the same number of letters in their titles.
Now Mac for sure heard a voice from the back. Male. Chang's statement was true, but was it one for true and two for false, or the other way around? He hesitated, listening while creeping to the top of the stairs.
Mac would know this, Chang said. One if true, two if...
Mac pressed one quickly.
Could have been a lucky guess, Chang said,
and Mac closed his eyes. Come on.
You have a contact in a very strategic location. Give me a beep for the number of letters in his sister's maiden name.
What? Chang would be so clever at a party. Okay, Chang's the contact. His sister is Ming Toy. Three. Wait. Maiden name. Same as Chang's. Wong. Four.
Mac punched them quickly, now peeking out of the darkened shack toward the back. He could see nothing.
Okay, Mac, right. Now listen. Talk to Stefanich as Conrad. He's going to make his guys bring Sebastian to you, so stay put, but don't waste time. He claims they've found the underground headquarters and will raid it at midnight. I don't have any numbers on the co-op people there, do you? One if yes, two if no.
Mac pressed twice.
I don't even know that they have phones. Can you send somebody to help? One if...
Mac beeped once.
Are you in immediate danger?
Mac beeped twice.
Okay, so you're somewhere where you can't talk. GPS shows you still where I talked to you last. Someone there with you?
Twice.
Outside?
Once.
See them?
Twice.
Okay, you hear them. Have you got personnel outside?
Once.
Both?
Once.
I'll let you go. You want me to stay on?
Twice.
Check in when you're clear. I want to know we're doing something for the co-op there.
Mac put his phone away and crept outside. Half a dozen armed peacekeepers milled about by the car.
I say we take it. We've hiked for hours.
No keys.
So hotwire it.
Come on, supposed to be only 500 more meters.
The peacekeepers headed east. Mac circled around to the front.
So Stefanich sent backup. Wonder if that's all of them.
Neither Hannah nor Chloe was by the tree. Mac made a noise through his teeth in case they were close by.
Nothing. He knelt in the darkness. The 50 was in place. The DEW was gone.
It felt to George as if Aristotle had turned left onto the road and driven east for about 20 minutes before pulling off to the side and waiting. He had once been able to keep track of the passage of time, but now he had to fight sleep. If he had to guess, George would have said they sat, not moving, for more than an hour. But neither would it have surprised him if it were actually twice that long. Finally, Aristotle said, "What do you think?"
"We could have gone long ago," Elena said. "The place clears out early, and there aren't that many people there anymore anyway."
"Plato?" "Yes, go. We've got to get back up here before long."
It seemed to George that they eventually made their way out of the woods and off the gravel road to a main road and were heading south. Then they went east, and he had the sense from ambience and sound that they were in a populated area, maybe town.
"Get him out of sight," Aristotle said a few minutes later. Plato reached and grabbed George by the right shoulder and pulled him over to where his head now lay in the big man's lap. Aristotle soon slowed and seemed to be parking.
"No, no," Plato said. "Around back."
Once they finally stopped and parked, Elena said,
"I'll see if we're clear."
George felt a cramp in his lower back but could do nothing about it. She returned and got back in the Jeep, shutting the door.
"About 20 minutes," she said.
"You got it," Aristotle said. "Let me see it."
"And it goes where?"
"About a foot below the top of the right door."
"I never noticed before."
"Can I sit him up?" Plato said. "Better wait."
Chloe stopped 50 feet back of Socrates and guessed they were close to 500 meters from the shack.
He was bent over, hands on his thighs, breathing heavily. His pace had slowed the last 100 meters or so, and maybe he was trying to come up with an approach to his comrades that would gain him sympathy rather than hostility. She was watching him carefully when she froze at the sound of footsteps on the gravel. Several. Not hurrying, not sneaking, just coming. She backed into the underbrush about 10 feet off the road and knelt, the knees of her camouflage pants immediately soaked through and cold. She fought the temptation to hold her breath, fearing she would exhale right when whoever was behind her came by. Chloe knew it couldn't be Mac and Hannah. There were too many. She was out of sight of Socrates now and hated not knowing whether he was off again. If he was, he would find his team without her knowing where. And here came half a dozen peacekeepers, weapons in hand. They were in no hurry, chatting, a couple smoking. Chloe tried to make it make sense. They seemed to have an idea where they were going. Same spot? She could follow them, and maybe more easily because of the noise they made. They were 10 feet past her, and she would wait another 30 seconds before venturing out. Her walkie-talkie gave 2 quick, staticky squawks, startling her. The peacekeepers kept walking and talking, but she panicked. Though they hadn't heard the sounds, if someone started talking to her, they'd hear that. She reached in her pocket to turn off the radio, but in feeling for the right knob, turned it up. Frantic to shut it off, she lurched, lost her balance, and flopped onto her seat.
"Johnson or Irene, come in, please."
Too loud. Chloe leaped to her feet, yanked out the radio, squeezed the transmit button twice, shut it off, and set herself, readying the Uzi. The peacekeepers had stopped and now crept her way. Mac pulled out his radio and whispered,
"Johnson here, Jenna. What's your 10-20?
100 yards northeast of rendezvous point.
You okay?
10-4.
GC troops in the woods, sir.
Irene with you?
Negative.
The DW?
Affirmative.
On my way.
How many?
Guessing 24, sir.
Come back?
Minimum 24.
Roger.
Be sure you're clear. Cease radio transmission and return to rendezvous ASAP.
Roger.
So much for bluffing Stefanich. Either he wasn't buying or he's royally stupid.
Johnson to Irene, Johnson to Irene, Johnson to Irene, do you read?
Mac looked at his watch, kicked the ground, pressed his lips together, and waited for Hannah. Chloe stood in the bramble, finger on the trigger, feet spread in the mushy ground. The peacekeepers stopped on the road, facing her position, close enough that she could hear their breathing. All 6 set their weapons at the same time. She could barely see them and assumed they couldn't see her. She held her breath and didn't move.
"GC!" one called out. "Who goes there?"
Chloe entertained the hope that they would all 6 decide they hadn't really heard anything.
"Show yourself or we spray the area."
"Friend," she called out. "GC here, too. Sister on assignment. Cool your jets."
"Armed?"
"Holding it over my head, peacekeeper. 10-1 I outrank you, so don't do anything rash."
A big flashlight made her squint. Holding the Uzi over her head, she said,
"Turn that thing off. We're all here on the same assignment."
The light went off.
"Hand over the weapon, ma'am, and we'll sort this out."
"No, we'll sort it out first. Now I'm tucking it under my arm to show my papers. Stand down now. So far, you've been by the book, and I can't fault you."
"Thank you. I'm going to need to turn the light onto your docks, ma'am."
"Hold on, I got a smaller beam. Going into the pocket."
With the weapon tucked and pointing her small flashlight at her papers, Chloe's heart drum-rolled against her chest.
"Superior officer, guys," the leader said. "Salute."
"No need," Chloe said. "Good job. A little sloppy on the march, but at least you're on time."
"What are you doing in the bushes, ma'am?"
"Following orders."
"Now wait here for my CO and another officer, and we'll go together." "That Uzi's not official issue, is it?"
"Something to look forward to."
"Really?
At my level, it is."
"Wow."
"We still reasonably on schedule," she said.
About 20 minutes early, ma'am.
Stand by, gentlemen.
Chloe pulled out her radio and turned it on.
Officer Irene to Senior Commander Johnson.
Johnson? Oh, man. Senior Commander! Chloe turned to the peacekeepers.
A little decorum, please.
Johnson, go ahead.
Sir, I've met up with 6 peacekeepers who will join us on the assignment, standing by for you approximately 480 meters east of your position.
6?
10-4.
Everything copacetic, Irene?
10-4.
For all I know, we could be surrounded, Mac told Hannah.
You sure you weren't seen?
Positive.
What is going on?
He called Chang and filled him in.
What do you think Stefanich is up to?
I'm in his mainframe, Mac, and there's nothing there. Could be as bad as they're on to you, or he's still trying to cover.
But what's he need all these people in the woods for? They mustering here for the midnight raid?
Seems out of the way.
Sure does. Unless they're wrong about the location of the underground headquarters. We're not far from where the pastor hid out Rayford. You think they've finally discovered that?
You're a good 30 miles from there, Mac. I'll stay on it, but I don't know what to tell you.
Aristotle said, All right, let's go. Plato shoved George up.
Someone opened his door, and it seemed Plato and Aristotle each took an arm and guided him while Elena opened doors. They led him about 15 feet up 3 concrete steps and inside. Then about 20 steps down a corridor that from the echoes seemed narrow, finally into a larger room. Aristotle let go of George and walked a few steps away.
Ah, I can't reach it. Plato,
give me that. George heard what sounded like metal being slotted into metal, then a couple of loud clicks. Plato grunted.
What's the secret here? He said.
Let me get the other side, Aristotle said, and he was replaced at George's side by Elena.
If only I weren't cuffed, George thought.
That was when he would have taken his chances. Cold cock the girl, whip off the blindfold, race back down that corridor and outside, and hope for the best. But not with his hands behind his back. Any hesitation, and she would shoot him, he was sure. Plato and Aristotle grunted, and Aristotle said,
Push him in, Elena. Come on, Plato and I have to get back.
Elena guided George forward, turned him sideways, and tried to force him through an opening apparently being held on each side by the men. He didn't fit.
Give me another couple of inches, she said,
and they grunted louder. She pushed George through.
Hold on now, Aristotle said. I don't want him found cuffed and blindfolded.
Hands reached in and unlocked the cuffs.
Toss me the blindfold, Elena said.
George slipped it off and saw he was inside a dark elevator. Elena had a weapon pointed at him. Good thing for them, George thought, because Plato and Aristotle were totally occupied holding the doors open. Elena took the blindfold, shoved it in a pocket, and pulled a bottle of water from another. She tossed it in and said,
Cheers!
As the door slammed shut. George let the bottle bounce on the floor and tried to get his fingers between the doors. Just when he had found purchase, he heard the key slide into its hole again and the throwing of the lock. He heard water sloshing and felt around in the dark for the bottle. He uprighted it and decided to save what was left for as long as he could. With his arms spread, George could touch the walls on each side, and as he made a quarter turn, he realized the enclosure was square. It didn't surprise him that the buttons on a panel were not working, but he could tell from the pattern that he was in a 4-story building. The ceiling was less than a foot above his head. George felt for loose panels, missing screws, anything. Everything felt secure. A thin plastic panel had to be the cover for the light. He removed that and felt a small circular double fluorescent tube. Next to that was a mesh panel. He pushed up hard on the side until it gave way, then ripped it down. Now he could feel the fan blades, dusty, oily. His body was already heating, and his breath was short. Were these people crazy? A malfunctioning elevator might make a perfect prison cell, but did they want him to suffocate? George shed his sweater and boots and socks and sat down, his back against the door. He found a boot and began swinging it backward over his shoulder against the door. "Knock it off, or I'll put you out of your misery," Elena called out. So they had left her alone to guard him. He wanted to tell her that if they didn't want a dead hostage to show to the brass, they'd better at least get the fan running. But he was committed not to speak, not a word, and so he kept banging. Chang had a bad feeling. Since the day he had been left as the only mole at the GC Palace, he had never felt so helpless. Was it possible Stefanich was play-acting? They seemed to have him intimidated, eager to please. Even if he had checked on Mac, Chang had everything in place to make Howie Johnson look legit. He was certain Stefanich was embarrassed to find he had doubted this high-level Johnson character and should now be trying to cover that he had ever doubted him. Chang was desperate to find out how vulnerable Mac and Chloe and Hannah were. Could they be walking into an ambush? Time was against him, but it might be wrong to just tell Mac to abort. Maybe they could hotwire the car at the shack and get back to the airport, but Chang knew Mac wouldn't abandon Sebastian. What if he was already dead? If Mac had been exposed, there was no reason for the GC to keep him alive. Chang slapped his forehead with both palms. Think! If they're on to Mac, why are they? If you can find the connection, maybe you can figure out what they might do. Chang started a global search, asking David Hasid's super-powered engine to match anyone at high levels in the palace with the GC at Ptolemais. He even keyed in code breakers in case the contact person feared someone within the palace was monitoring them. With the computer whirring away, darting through thousands of files in hundreds of locations, Chang fell to his knees. God, I have never asked you to override a piece of equipment. But you know a servant of yours designed this, and I want to serve you too. Help me think. Speed the process. Please let me protect these brothers and sisters. I know from what happened at Petra today that nothing is beyond you. We have lost so much to the enemy, and I know we will lose more before your ultimate victory. But don't let the Greek believers suffer more. Not tonight. Protect the co-op, and help me get Mac and Chloe and Hannah and George out of there. Mac liked a clear mission, a black-and-white assignment. This one was infiltrate, then storm the gates, free your man, and hit the road. Now there was the underground complication. He wouldn't leave Greece without his man, and now he couldn't leave without defending the believers. The original plan didn't figure he and his people would be outnumbered. There were four hostage takers. Mac, his two team members, and George made four good guys. Those odds he could live with. But to walk Hannah down the road to Chloe and 6GC, knowing there were at least two dozen more in the area, well, that didn't make sense. "Hold up," he told Hannah. "You know how to hotwire a car?" "Do I admit it or not?" "Just say so. Time is not on our side." "Yes. Do it." While she trotted to Sebastian's car, Mac radioed Chloe. "Johnson to Irene." "Irene, go. Unforeseen delay here. Need your assistance. 10-4. Should I bring help?" "Negative. Let them go on. We'll catch up." "You heard the boss, gentlemen," Chloe said. "We'll see you at the destination."
"We'd love to help the senior commander, ma'am."
"Thank you, no.
Can we meet him later?"
"I'll see to it."
And as she said it, Chloe was overwhelmed with a deep impression, and she had to express herself.
"If you do me a favor."
"Anything, ma'am."
"Senior Commander Johnson's presence tonight is a surprise for Commander Stefanich. He's going to be compensated for some of his recent actions, so..."
"Don't let on is coming?"
"Exactly."
"You got it, ma'am. And you know what? We didn't know Commander Stefanich was going to be here. Fact is, we don't know what we're doing here."
Chloe blanched. What if Stefanich wasn't there?
"It's all part of the surprise, boys."
Chang knew God had protected him, probably more than he realized. But he had no reason to think God owed him anything or was obligated to act in this instance, just because Chang had asked. With zero confidence that his pleas had done any good, Chang wearily returned to his chair before the computer. The screen was alive with red flashes. The search engine had reached secure files at the highest levels and was matching, comparing, translating languages, turning spoken word into written. A small box in the upper right-hand corner showed 6 matches already between some element of the GC operation in Ptolemais with top brass at the palace. Top. Chang feared multitasking would slow the search, but he had to take the chance. Mac and the 2 women were in danger, outnumbered, without any idea what they faced. He checked the first 3 matches and found they were routine interactions of Ptolemais administration reporting statistics to GC command. But the 4th was different. It was highest security interaction, a series of emails between TB and OT, plus more than 1 phone call, also between the same 2, being reduced to typed transcription. Chang keyed in. Match logic? The response was immediate. Meets broad, simple criteria.